Thank you for the introduction. And thank you for those who are staying and, like myself, are missing out on the march. And I also want to thank the Socialist Caucus for allowing me the opportunity to provide a possibly unique perspective on social determinants of health and racism. So bear with me here. So I have no relationships to disclose. So, as stated in outline, what I hope to do is speak on one or two tenets of Chinese medicine, discuss a couple of concepts on how Chinese medicine defines the emotions, and then describe the potential emotional, psycho-emotional impact on Black America more from a pathophysiological perspective. Basically, and that's why I say bear with me, basically I'm condensing 3,000 years of ancient medicine into a 15-20 minute conversation. So that's why I ask that you all bear with me. So what I did for, and this is actually based on my thesis that I had to do for my master's degree in Oriental medicine. And basically what I did was in my school we studied pretty in-depth the Huang Di Neijing, which is translated as the Yellow Emperor's classic on internal medicine. And so I, in my studying of this text, and it's the oldest text to my knowledge on Chinese medicine, and what I did was I found passages that allowed me to stretch their context to what we're seeing in today's society. And so the first one happens to be, while making diagnosis, a physician asked the patient to learn if he used to be a member of the nobility but now is a member of the humility or a commoner. If this is the case, the patient may not be under the attack of pathogens, but his disease could have been caused by internal factors, otherwise the five emotions, which is called nutritive energy in a state of prostration. As you can see, it's very eloquently written and translated. But what that was based on is in ancient China, there was this hierarchical system. At the top, you had the emperor all the way down, various officials all the way down to the peasants. What I did was stretch that and state, well, let's apply this to the sense of humankind. All of humankind fall into that category of nobility. However, throughout episodes of human history, we've seen not just individuals, but whole communities subjugated, oppressed, marginalized to various degrees, and based on various, various quote-unquote justifications. So, and basically what this is saying is that diseases that may take place in these persons may not be because of, say, a germ or a virus, but may be because of the now disimbalance of their emotional competency. The next passage I took was, when a person has his power taken away from him after losing his noble status, he may not be under the attack of pathogens, but his pure energy and spirits will be harmed internally, which will cause disease. It basically, this passage, while it supports the first one, what I would like for you to focus on is the fact that power, the way I interpreted it, was one's mental, emotional, and spiritual capacity. And once someone being possibly demoted from that noble status, they again may not be under the attack of, say, a bacteria or a virus, but they perhaps may be more harmed internally, i.e. those particular powers succumbing to that demotion, which hence causes disease or can lead to disease. And then lastly, in making diagnosis of a disease, it is necessary to ask the patient concerning his eating habits and place of residence to see if he's been suffering from extreme joy or misery, if he used to be happy but miserable now, all of which are harmful to pure energy. This one alludes more to social determinants of health. As we all know, considering a person's eating habits, but not only their eating habits, their access to food, as well as their place of residence, because of the history of residential segregation, can lead to and create pathogenic conditions, as we very well know. And so that's basically what this passage, when I stretch the context, that's what that passage alludes to. And the key word that is the connective tissue for all these three passages that's impacted by the emotions, the eating habits, the loss of power, is the word energy. And in Chinese medicine, we use the term qi for that. Researchers who are finding ways to measure energy related to Chinese medicine prefer a term called, I believe it's bioenergy. So just know that for the rest of this discussion, when I speak on energy, qi, or bioenergy, I'm talking about the same thing. Okay? And qi for the human body manifests itself in various aspects. Everybody has qi. It's something you're born with, and it's just like in the laws of physics. It can't be created nor destroyed, just manifests itself in various ways. And in various ways in the human body, as you can see from the slide here, is the emotions, the mind and the spirit, the organs, muscles and tissues, as well as blood and circulation. And so what I focused mostly on was the emotions, as well as some aspects of the psyche, which involves the mind and the spirit. And the emotions in Chinese medicine, the emotions, as we know, are mental stimuli, ubiquitous to the human experience. We all have cycled through them at one point or another, and even now. So in Chinese medicine, they regard these emotions, though, as fluid movements of qi. In other words, they're psychological reactions to external circumstances that we confront day in and day out. And they only become causes of disease when they become prolonged or too intense. And I think even most people would agree that even Western medical research is starting to see this now as well. And when they become causes of disease, they create movement of qi that's contrary to its normative flow. And another interesting thing about the emotions is that in Chinese medicine, they pair specific emotions with specific organ systems. So as you can see from the slide, they pair the emotion of joy with the heart, the emotion of worry with the stomach, grief with the lung, fear with kidney, and anger with the liver. And I'll come back to that, back to this slide in a moment. Because I'm sure now you're all possibly wondering, what the heck does this have to do with racism and social determinants of health? So hopefully the way I can tie this in is allowing me to paint the following scenario. And that is, you have, say, an individual, 47-year-old black male, come to you complaining of chest pain, numbness and tingling in the extremities, high blood pressure, as well as abnormal triglycerides or abnormal fat in the blood, with a chronic history of hypertension. You now have a recipe, or a chronic history of uncontrolled hypertension, let's say. You now have a history or a recipe for potential acute cardiac arrest, which this patient actually succumbed to. And so, but you decide to take it a little further and investigate what possibly led to some of his, what led to that, him being into that state. And so what you have here is the social determinants of health. And on one side is what we in the States consider them to be, and on the other side is what the World Health Organization considers. And you can see there's overlap, you know, with the two. But in terms of this particular patient, let's say he, in terms of housing, his housing situation was dilapidated, crime infested, constantly accosted by addicts as well as police. And he had no mail service in terms of the U.S. Postal System were scared for their own lives in coming to such an area, which meant he might have not received information pertaining to medical follow-ups, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of education, as we know, housing or residence can impact education. Well, in this person's case, he happened to be a high school dropout by the 10th grade. And with them, to compound that, we know that education impacts employment opportunities and income earning ability. In this case, he was employed with various jobs earning meager salaries, but unfortunately, by the time of his demise, he was unemployed. And employment and income can lead to ability to gain access to medical care or health care. Well, in this case, because he was unemployed, he was also uninsured. And as we know, uninsured usually means having to rely on community clinic services, which is fine, it's great. I've worked in several. And however, for this individual, the community clinics that he relied on were not only on the other side of town, but they were also understaffed, overwhelmed, and at times a little culturally insensitive to their target community. So that paints a picture in terms of the social factors that impacted this individual. And we know that the list in this slide are impacted by money, power, and resources, which even to this day, unfortunately, are unequally distributed. And that unequal distribution leads to, and I quote, a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on social interpretation of how one looks that, number one, unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities, number two, unfairly advantages other individuals and community, and number three, ultimately saps the strength of the whole society through the wasting of valuable human resources. What I've just described for you is racism as defined by Dr. Kamar Jones. And so, in terms of this individual who I just described to you, his experience with racism and discrimination occurred in terms of him being racially profiled in various situations throughout his life, as well as not considered in terms of medical interventions, not considered for certain high-tech procedures and other diagnostic and treatment interventions. And when the conversation on racism occurs, following the definition by Dr. Kamar Jones, she defined three levels in terms of institutionalized, which manifests itself in access to political power, access to quality education, sound housing, etc. There's personally mediated, and this particular personally mediated is what most people think of when you talk about racism and discrimination, because prejudice is involved in that, and it can be intentionally occurring or unintentionally occurring. And then you have internalized racism, which is basically one taking on the negative characteristics of society's negative characteristics of one's own self-worth and value. Also to the discussion, it helps to talk about segregation, which is the physical separation of races. And the reason why that's important is simply because throughout the history of this country, segregation was imposed by legislation, enforced in housing authorities, as well as enshrined in certain federal housing policies. And then the topic of discrimination comes up. More, even though it decreases access to desirable goods and services, discrimination is important because this is a potential psychosocial stressor, because it can be real or perceived in, if you talk to individuals. All of this, though, creates conditions that increase exposure to traditional stresses, such as unemployment, pathogenic residential conditions, and decreased access to medical care. So, coming back to this slide again, since our patient died of cardiac arrest, I felt to tie this all in. Let's focus on then the organ of the heart and the emotion of joy. And most people would figure, why is joy considered even, quote unquote, maybe even a pathogenic emotion? Well, it's not. In Chinese medicine, joy is defined as impacting rather the circulation, because when the circulation is good, there's a natural feeling of being alive, and on a psychological level, there's a sense of unison with oneself that's aligned with the sovereignty of the heart. And the heart in Chinese medicine is known as the emperor, or in a woman's case, the empress of the organ systems. And so, and what I'm hoping to do is paint a picture, and you start to tie in the pathophysiology as well. The pathology of joy can be twofold, meaning there can be an excess of joy or a deficiency of joy. In either case, there's a disruption of the excitation of life. That excitation of life equates to the beating of the heart. And so that excess, in excess, joy can disrupt, creating a sense of agitation, affecting blood circulation, inducing palpitations, increasing heart rate. In deficiency, such a disruption can create an inability to remain present within oneself, because as I stated before, when the relationship with oneself is good, then you're centered. You have a conscientious awareness of who you are and what you're about. But such a disruption can also, in a deficient state, can lead to also palpitations and other symptoms above, along with a blockage and obstruction. Otherwise, the heart, in other words, in the Huang Di Nei Jing, the heart has a fullness. And similar to what I was equating to is a congestive heart failure, possibly. And so from there, you have this pathological impetus from the emotions impacting on the organ systems. And so you consider one's social factors and racism itself, and you realize that these emotions play out significantly in looking at one's emotional and mental competence. And so basically what I started to see from reading the passages and tying everything together was that they were basically talking about the stress response in a lot of ways. 3,000 years ago, they were talking about this in their own eloquent way. Because as we know from the work of Hans Selye and others, this is exactly what the stress response occurs. And if you think about the social determinants of health and phenomena such as racism, when you do become impacted, your body starts to stay in this agitated state, to use the term. And so we see in the blue is the effects more of the chronic and prolonged stress, which is what I tended to focus on, because in the concept of chronic disease, that's what you tend to see most. And so in conclusion, to take some quotes from Dr. Selye, it may be said without hesitation that for man, the most important stresses are emotional. And that's because when the body's in harmony, it doesn't ask for anything other than what it needs. Hence, when one has the essentials of what it needs, food, clothing, shelter, opportunity to work and make a living, one feels at harmony with oneself. When those things are not present or not in play, then one starts to become disembalanced, so to speak, internally, more on a mental, emotional aspect. And don't get me wrong, everybody processes things in their own way differently, but by and large, the stressors that impact the community are, or can be, emotional. And then to use another quote by Dr. Selye, is that you may feel that there's no conceivable relationship between the behavior of ourselves, for instance, in inflammation, and our conduct in everyday life. I do not agree. And I agree with that in the sense of there is this constant interplay between our biology and our biography. In other words, I believe Dr. Christine Northrup even said, our biography becomes our biology. And so what you can translate that is to various communities throughout human history that have been marginalized and oppressed. It's something to take in consideration, particularly if we're trying to use more of a holistic measure. And to me, the social determinants of health do fall into the holistic aspect of someone's well-being. And then lastly, just to comment on what I'm attempting to try and do is see how this may apply in the realm of community psychology regarding the empowerment theory as well as ecological systems theory that was proposed or that has been proposed by Yuri Bronfenbrenner. So those are my references. And lastly, just want to acknowledge those who were essential in helping me putting this together. Thank you.